The winner. A great shout went up at this, and the suitors started pushing each other out of the way in their eagerness to be the first to try. Telemachus hopped up from his bench onto the table to quieten them down. "You really are worse than wild dogs, and stupider. Yes, you can argue amongst yourselves until you start brawling, or you can draw lots and do this like civilized gentlemen." Annoyed as they were to be insulted by one they regarded as an impertinent child, they could not but see the sense of his suggestion. While they began to organize the lottery, Telemachus continued, "I can't see any reason why I shouldn't be the first to try this," he said. "If I can do it, well, I shan't marry my mother. This isn't Thebes, after all. But if I do succeed, she won't need to marry again, and the pack of you can go back home and leave Ithaca in peace. What is more," he said, as much to himself as to anyone else, "I'll have proved myself my father's son." He jumped down and called out to Eumaeus and Philoetius. First, he instructed them to go to the storerooms and fetch 12 wooden tripods. These they set out in a long row down the centre of the hall. On top of each tripod, Telemachus placed an axe head. Greek tripods were not quite like ours, of course. They were essentially large dishes on three legs, used ceremonially for burning incense, or for heaping sacrificial grain or other foods for the gods. Or, if it pleased you, you could, like the Pythia at Delphi, sit on them. When he had done this 12 times, he went to the first tripod, put his eye to the hole, and directed Eumaeus and Philoetius until he was satisfied that all 12 were exactly aligned. That done, Telemachus leaned forward and whispered briefly to Eumaeus and Philoetius in turn. They each shot him a look of surprise before stepping back and leaving the hall. Despite themselves, the suitors were rather impressed by Telemachus's swift efficiency, especially given that he had never witnessed the setup or seen his father perform the feat. But surely he wouldn't be able to string the bow, let alone shoot an arrow through the axe heads. If a mere boy could, then the task was insultingly easy, and in all likelihood every suitor would complete it, in which case they would be back where they started, with Penelope still needing to make her choice. Telemachus had taken up the bow. It was a remarkable weapon, made not of wood, but of ibex horn. This gave it a strength unmatched by any conventional equivalent. With a nervous smile, Telemachus tied a line of bowstring to the end of the top limb, took a deep breath, and pulled down. Almost nothing happened. The suitors tittered. Telemachus tried a second and third time, seemingly making no impression at all except a sharp pain on the fleshy inside of his fingers as the bowstring cut in. So rigid and unyielding was the ibex horn. The fourth time, he held the bow between his legs and pulled the two limbs together with a final huge effort. The bow began to bend. Perhaps he could do it. A small cough close at hand caused him to look up. He caught his father's eye and saw him give an almost imperceptible shake of the head. With a laugh, Telemachus put down the bow, untied the string, and gave a cheerfully resigned shrug. "Well, this beats me, I must say," he said. "Damn thing might as well be carved out of marble." Antinous laughed. "My turn." Eurymachus held up a hand. "Antinous, we've just conducted a lottery for the order, and as leader, I will make the first attempt. Then the rest of you may go in your lottery order as you please. Hand me the bow." He clicked his fingers impatiently towards Telemachus, as if the Prince of Ithaca were little better than a wine steward. Antinous seized the bow and addressed the hall. "You see, as with so much in life, a little thought is required here. I think I know the trick of it. You, Melanthius, to the storerooms. Command the custodian to give you a large ball of wax." Melanthius, the goatherd who had been so rude to Odysseus and Eumaeus, haired off excitedly. "There's a technique to everything, after all," Antinous continued, in the manner of a tutor teaching a class of more than ordinarily backward pupils. "It just demands a little forward thinking." He raised the bow and made a huge effort to bend the two limbs inwards. "Yes," he said, panting slightly. "Stiff, you see? Aged and stiff, like our friend the smelly beggar over there." He pointed the bow towards Odysseus, who grinned and bowed. "But apply a little common sense, and a little of this." Melanthius had come in brandishing a ball of wax above his head. Antinous took it, went to the great fireplace, stuck it onto the end of a poker, and waved it over the flames. He had the attention of the entire hall. Penelope, who had taken up a position halfway up the staircase, as if ready at any moment to return to her bedchamber, frowned slightly. Telemachus appeared to be genuinely concerned. Had Antinous discovered a technique? The idea of that man as a stepfather. Telemachus would kill him, and then himself, if such a thing should come to pass. Odysseus, however, took this opportunity to slip out of the hall, where a puzzled Eumaeus and Philoetius were waiting in the passageway. "Thank you," Odysseus said. "Now, I'm just a poor beggar, but sometimes I get fancies. Here's one. Suppose some god decided that this was the evening when your old master Odysseus would return to you. And further suppose that he began to exact his revenge on the suitors. Where would you stand? What would you do?" Eumaeus and Philoetius stared at him wide-eyed.
"As I told you before, sir," said Eumaeus, "I'd fight by his side."
"Aye, and die by his side if need be," said Philoetius.
"That's all I needed to know. Now, look." He drew back his clothes and revealed the scar on his thigh. "See? I am Odysseus. I have returned, and soon, with your help, the suitors will be lying dead in that hall, every last one of them. No, no, up, on your feet." They had both fallen down and grasped his knees. Odysseus pulled them up and embraced them. "Now, let's go back inside and watch this comedy unfold." Back in the hall, Antinous was kneading the ball of wax in his hands. Melanthius pointed at the proceeding, mouth agape with amazement, as if demonstrating one of the great wonders of the world. Satisfied that the waxy animal fat was softened enough, Antinous now walked up the centre of the hall, past each of the 12 tripods. As he went, he vigorously applied tallow to the entire length of the bow, sliding his palm up and down to work it in. This caused some tittering in the crowd.
"Like getting seed from a bull,"
someone whispered to raucous laughter.
"Silence!"
barked Antinous. He nodded to Telemachus, who handed him the bowstring. "Now, out of the way." Telemachus stepped back to watch. Silence fell. Antinous took up the bow, tied on the string at one end, and pulled down. Nothing. With a brisk nod, as if to say this was exactly what he had expected, he now grasped the bow by the ends and pulled hard. His top hand slipped straight down and banged against the other. "Damn it!" He angrily snatched a cloth from Melanthius. "Too slick! Must work the wax right in. There!" On the third attempt, his hand didn't slip down, but neither did he bend the bow.
"I think one end might have quivered slightly," said Odysseus, trying to be helpful.
"Quiet, you damn fool!"
Red in the face, Antinous slammed the bow onto the table and glared at Telemachus.
"I don't believe your father ever managed this. It manifestly cannot be done."
"Sir," said Telemachus, "if you are calling my mother a liar, then I must—"
No, of course not. I merely meant—"
Antinous executed a hasty half-bow in the direction of Penelope.
"The weapon may have been more supple 20 years ago, when Odysseus was able to string it, but now—"
"According to the lottery, I'm next,"
said Leodes, who was far from the leader of the group. Indeed, he had, as their diviner, many times warned the suitors that the day would come when they would have to pay for the liberties they were taking in Penelope's household. Leodes wiped down the bow, but came no closer to stringing it than Antinous. Each suitor stepped up. Each suitor tried. None managed to bend the bow's unyielding limbs so much as the breadth of a fly's wing. When the last had tried and failed, Antinous took to the table.
"Here's what we do. We abandon the test tonight, but tomorrow morning we all go outside and offer sacrifices to Apollo, the god of archers. We will reserve the absolute best and juiciest thigh bones and cuts of meat for him. He will reward us by sending power to our arms and guiding our aim. You can guarantee it."
"But excuse me,"
came a slightly quavering voice.
"I haven't tried yet."
Odysseus, leaning on his beggar's staff and somehow looking frailer and older than before, pointed with his free hand at the bow.
You haven't tried yet?" Antinous repeated before bursting out with laughter. The whole hall began to bray and hoot and stamp their feet. Antinous's amusement swiftly turned to cold anger.
"Out! Get out, old man! I've put up with you long enough. Someone throw this stinking dog out onto the shit heap."
Telemachus jumped on the table.
"No, I forbid it. What did the queen say?"
He turned to Penelope.
"Mother, did you not say, whichever one of you here is capable? Were those not your words?"
Penelope, though puzzled by the earnest heat with which her son was addressing her, nodded. "Yes, I believe those were my words.
Whichever one of you here."
"Well,"
Telemachus stooped to pick up the bow,
"this gentleman is one of us here, and must therefore be allowed to try his luck."
While the suitors clamoured and debated the matter, Odysseus whispered to Eurycleia, "When I stoop forward to try the bow, all eyes will be on me. I want you to go out into the corridor and bolt every door to this hall from the outside. You understand? Lock us all in." Pink with excitement, Eurycleia bustled out. Telemachus looked to Penelope.
"Well, mother?"
A look of great sadness passed over Penelope's face. She had rather enjoyed her conversation with that old beggar earlier in the day, and did not like the idea of him being made a fool of.
"He must be allowed to try," she said. "Of course he must. But it is not something I wish to witness."
She turned and went upstairs. Once she reached her bedchamber, she fell onto the bed and into a sleep so deep One might have imagined that it had been induced by a god of some kind, perhaps even Athena herself. Meanwhile, in the hall below, Odysseus shuffled his way to the table. Telemachus bent down to hand him the bow. "Here it is, old fellow, and there on the table you see the quiverful of arrows? And as it happens," he added in a low whisper, so only Odysseus could hear, "there are more in that box next to it." Odysseus mumbled his thanks, took the bow, and eyed it up and down, wonderingly. "It's called a bow," a man sang out, as if explaining to a backward child.
"Ah," said Odysseus, "a bow."
Holding it up with one hand, he pulled off his cloak with the other and slung the quiver over his back. Now he examined every part of the bow, turning it in his fingers to see if, over the past 20 years, some worm or other might have burrowed into the horn and weakened it.
"Oh, quite the connoisseur," someone shouted. "Looks like the queen has finally found her future husband," called out another, two appreciative snorts.
But a hush quickly fell. Odysseus had taken the bowstring, tied it to the upper limb of the bow, and pulled it down towards the lower in a single smooth movement that seemed to take no effort at all. Like a musician calmly stringing a lyre, Odysseus tied a knot to the other end and brought up the bow to eye level. He twice drew back the string, flexing the bow, and nodded to himself. Not a sound could be heard in the hall, as now he stepped forward to face the line of 12 tripods on which stood the 12 axe heads. He took an arrow from the quiver at his shoulder and set its nock on the bowstring. His left fist clutched the center of the bow. Laying the arrow on top of the fist, he curled his topmost finger over the shaft. The arrow now ran smoothly between his index and middle fingers. He let out a long, soft sigh. There was not a man in the room who did not recognize at once that, whatever else he might be, this scrawny old beggar was a practiced archer. The handling was so confident, so precise, so swift. Odysseus stepped back until he was the length of perhaps 2 horses from the first tripod. He sighted the hole in the center of the first axe head and pulled the bowstring back and back and back until, creaking with the tension, it reached his right eye. He held it there. Everyone in the hall held their breath. Odysseus let go. The arrow fizzed through the first axe head, the second, the third. It flew through all 12 without touching the sides. The tip buried itself in the rightmost wooden post of the fireplace with a dead thud that echoed like thunder in the silence of the hall. Odysseus sprang onto the table and again drew his bow.
"And now the real fun begins," he cried.
Antinous stood, outraged.
"Who the hell do you think you are?"
Those were his last words. Odysseus let loose an arrow that flew straight to Antinous, piercing his throat. Blood spurted from his nose, his eyes, and his ears. Gargling, he clutched at the arrow and fell back dead, his eyes still staring in disbelief. Now the hall was in uproar. The suitors went to the walls to pull down spears and shields. But of course the walls were bare. Shouts of fury rang out, but Odysseus's voice topped them all.
He asked me who the hell I thought I was. I'll tell you who the hell I think I am. I think I am Odysseus of Ithaca, come back from the dead to revenge myself upon you. You fucking animals! You thought I was never coming back, didn't you? You thought you could loot my palace, devour my food, rape my housemaids, beat my servants, ransack my estate, plan my son's murder, drive my mother to the grave, and lay siege to my wife. Well, it's time to pay.
Eurymachus came forward, trembling, arms outstretched.
Odysseus, if it really is you, spare our lives. It was Antinous, always Antinous. It was his idea to murder your son. At every turn, he was the one who urged us on. As for your property, we can repay you 10, 20 oxen from every man here. Every goat, every sheep, every bushel of wheat, every barrel of wine. We'll repay you double. Oh, of course you're angry, but I beg you, forgive us. We'll make good, I swear. You'll make good. You'll unrape the women and girls, will you? You'll unbeat the servants and bring back my mother from the grave. No, you have two choices and two choices only. Stand and fight or run and be cut down.
Eurymachus drew a dagger from his belt and, screaming a blood-curdling war cry, hurled himself at Odysseus, who took one step backwards and let loose an arrow. It flew straight into Eurymachus's side, piercing the liver. He fell to the floor, screaming in agony. He jerked and thrashed and kicked for a full half minute before death took him. Telemachus looked on in wonder. A movement high above him caught his eye. Was that an eagle perched on the rafters, and next to it an owl? Telemachus shook his head and turned back to watch his father, who was loading and shooting arrows into the crush of suitors like a machine. Every tip found its mark in flesh and ended a life. Dozens of panicked suitors threw themselves against the locked doors, screaming to be let out, begging Odysseus for mercy. But there was not a shred of mercy alive in Odysseus's soul. Blood washed over the floor and splashed against the walls. Telemachus looked up at the rafters again. He must have imagined the eagle and the owl. Amphinomus, sword drawn, ran around to attack Odysseus from behind. Odysseus never saw him, but Telemachus had a clear view and launched a spear. His aim was good. The point tore into Amphinomus's side, killing him instantly. As he ran forward to wrench out his spear, he called hurriedly to Odysseus, who never stopped drawing, aiming, and loosing while he listened. You're going to run out of arrows soon, father. There's a sword, shield, and helmet for you in the corner, as arranged, but I'll go to the storerooms and bring more for the rest of us. Be quick, son. Odysseus held the suitors at bay. Had they gathered themselves together under a leader, they could have split into groups, rushed, and overpowered him. But the implacable coldness in his eye and the faultless flights of his arrows unmanned them completely. Telemachus returned to the hall, bearing spears, helmets, and shields. Philoetius helped unburden him, but Telemachus was muttering curses against himself. As I was coming back, I saw that treacherous goatherd Melanthius slip out of the door. I just know he'll be heading to the storerooms to get weapons for the suitors. I was too laden to lock up when I left. The supply of arrows was rapidly depleting. Without taking his eyes off his targets, Odysseus told Eumaeus and Philoetius to stop Melanthius.
Show the runt no mercy,
he called after them as they slipped away. Telemachus, meanwhile, was wading in with his sword, hacking at suitors to the right and left. The final arrow shot, Odysseus cast aside his now useless bow and allowed himself a second to admire his son's balance, skill, and sheer ferocity. Eumaeus and Philoetius found Melanthius in the storerooms. He had been loading up a cart with spears and swords. When he saw that he was cornered, he set it down and gave a sickly grin.
Oh, I was just getting weapons for Odysseus. How wonderful that he has returned! This is the day we have long prayed for, eh, brothers? Liar! Shouted Eumaeus.
Philoetius took up a length of rope and tested its strength.
You must be tired. Time for a rest, said Eumaeus.
They left him hoisted up in the rafters, hog-tied, howling in agony and begging to be let down. Back on the killing floor of the great hall, the dead now far outnumbered the living. With spear and sword, Odysseus and Telemachus drove Agelaus, Euronymous, Demoptolemus, Pisander, Polybus, and Amphimedon into a corner and finished them off. Leodes crawled out from under a table and clutched Odysseus by the knees, imploring mercy.
My lord, I was only their priest. I committed no crimes against your house. Spare me, I beg.
The rage that burned in Odysseus did not abate.
Only their priest? Yes, and how diligently you prayed that I might never return.
He swung down his sword, cutting clean through Leodes' neck. His head rolled under the table he had crawled out from. The next to grovel on their knees before Odysseus were Phemius the bard and Medon the herald. As he once more brought up his sword, Telemachus stayed his arm.
Father, these two are innocent. Phemius has always praised you in his songs. Medon has always been a kind friend to me. They are good, loyal men.
Odysseus put up his sword and smiled.
You have my son to thank for your lives. Now, go outside to the courtyard. Prepare the staff to come and clean up in here.
Odysseus and Telemachus surveyed the scene. Bodies piled on bodies, heaped together like a vast catch of fish. Father and son splashed ankle-deep through a lake of blood to finish off with swift stabs of their spears those whom death had not yet released. They searched every corner of the room for any further signs of movement. There were none. They stood leaning against each other, breathing heavily.
Father, can it really be? All 108?
I told you, son, with Athena and Zeus on our side, we could not lose.
I did not see them there.
Didn't you feel them? In your arm and in your eye? Didn't you feel them here?
Odysseus thumped his fist against his chest. Telemachus remembered the owl and the eagle in the rafters and wondered. He looked at Odysseus, smeared and spattered with gore. He looked like a lion that had just raised its head from the bloody carcass of a deer. Odysseus looked at Telemachus. He had summoned to his mind so many imagined pictures of his son over the past 20 years, but in none of them had the boy been streaked and splashed in blood from head to toe. A sudden shrill wailing made them turn. Eurycleia, the nurse, stood in the doorway, surveying the carnage. The noise she made was not one of terror or revulsion, however. It was a wild, exultant ululation, a gleeful shriek of triumph. Telemachus was shocked.
Nanny!
Odysseus went over and led her gently back out. We may glory over the dead in our hearts, but not with outward shows of joy, he said. Now, you can be helpful to me. It will take some time to clean out this slaughterhouse. I will let you know when it is fit for Penelope to come down. Eumaeus and Philoetius had gathered a team from the palace and the outlying barns. They came in now to pile up the dead in carts and to purge and fumigate the hall with sulphur candles, torches, and incense. The work was long and terrible. Odysseus and Telemachus did their share. Finally, they stood back, arms over each other's shoulders, surveying the hall. Telemachus laughed. It's going to take me a long time to get used to this, Papa. Get used to what? And don't call me that. To get used to this. Telemachus spun around, a huge smile on his face. The empty silence. It's so damn quiet. No banging of dice on the table, no rattling of cups and plates, no terrible singing, no fights breaking out every 10 minutes. Eurycleia curtsied in front of them. Looking lovely now, isn't it, my boys? I mean, you'd never know. Time, then, said Odysseus, feeling unaccountably nervous, to bring down Penelope. And I can tell her who you are at last. Yes, you can tell her.